Today's Teisho will be on case 44 in the Heikigan Roku, the Blue Rock Collection, the PNU. Case 44 is entitled Kasan's Beating the Drum. Main subject, Kasan said, learning by study is called hearing. Learning no more is called nearness. Transcending these two is true passing. A monk asked, what is true passing? Kasan said, beating the drum. The monk asked again, what is the true teaching of the Buddha? Kasan said, beating the drum. The monk asked once more, I would not ask you about this very mind as the Buddha, but what is no mind, no Buddha? Kasan said, beating the drum. The monk continued to ask, when an enlightened one comes, how do you treat him? Kasan said, beating the drum. Secho's verse, dragging a stone, carrying earth, use the spiritual power of a 1,000-ton bow. Zokutsu Roshi rolled out 3 wooden balls. How could they surpass Kasan's beating the drum? I will tell you, what is sweet is sweet, what is bitter, bitter. I want to thank everybody for doing such a wonderful job this morning in the Zendo. There's really deep sitting going on here, and it's quite wonderful to see. All of you have made arrangements to be here, sacrifices, and all of you are throwing yourself into your practice wholeheartedly. And it's just wonderful, wonderful to see. So thank you. Please keep going. Please have no reservations, no expectations. Just be fully in this moment. That's what Zen practice is all about. The ideal of Zen practice is unified mind in accord with the way. This is the ideal. It's not necessarily what we think Buddhism is about at first. People who come to beginners classes at Rutgers on a Monday night some of them might be curious, right? So some people are just coming to see what meditation is all about, and those people are kind of cute, you know, because they come in and they're intrigued. And I explain what to do, and they'll get in the right posture, and I'll say, "Are you in any pain?" And no. And then they go through a period of meditation, and some of them leave after the first sit, and some of them leave even sooner. On Friday, this last Friday, I think it was, we had a woman who came. Along, she came, I guess she, I don't know if she came by herself or not, but she didn't even last through one sit, and she left. And I just think she wasn't really interested, you know. But some people come to sit, and they're coming because they have an urgent need to practice. You know, those people are, I'm happy to meet the people in the first group. I'm happy to meet people who are just curious, because you never know, you know. Somebody might come and give it a try, and 10 years later might remember coming. But there are people who come to the Zendo who are, they have like an urgent need, right? And those people I'm very happy to meet, because of course I was in that category too long ago. And they come to the Zendo because they're having trouble, right, often. Something in their life isn't right, and they're unhappy, or they're unable to put their minds at ease in the world. And that has various kinds of symptoms, right? And I was one of these people. I was very stressed out all the time when I was young. And I had a job running a restaurant at one time that was really beyond me. And I would just dread going into that job. I've talked about this, I think, before, but one of the jobs I had when I got out of college was managing a restaurant. And I had never managed a restaurant before. I'd worked in a restaurant. Running this restaurant was incredibly stress-inducing, because I had been a college student, and I hope if you were a humanities major, you won't be offended if I say that as a humanities major, I got to sleep almost whenever I wanted to. You know? So, in other words, I could pick my courses, you know, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, and I could read, but I wasn't under like perpetual pressure cooker type stress. I know that people in the sciences sometimes are under a lot of stress as undergraduates. I was under very little stress. So when I got out of college, I was used to coasting, sort of, and I took this job running a restaurant, and I had to get there at 7 in the morning, and I had to do ordering, and I had to meet with salespeople, and I was going all day long, day after day, for 6 days a week. And I often did cooking. I had to, you know, if we were short, I would cook. And I cooked routinely, you know, I helped in the kitchen. And if somebody didn't show up for breakfast, I did the breakfast shift, because I was called the manager, but really I was supposed to do all these different jobs. I was supposed to balance the books. At the end of the night, I was supposed to go over the accounts and make sure the accounts were right. And if there was money short, I had to account for it. And if there was money over, so sometimes I was there until like 2 o'clock in the morning trying to square the books. And it was stressful. If somebody didn't like his meal, they'd complain. Sometimes they'd make a scene. I had a suit coat I used to have to put on, and I'd have to go out of my office and talk to the people and say, you didn't like your shrimp? Why didn't you like your shrimp? And I, you know, they always ate them, but after they ate them, they complained, you know. And I didn't point that out, usually, you know. Because the policy was don't fight with a customer, you know, you want to have a happy customer. So I would always say, well, what would make you happy, you know, and so on. But it was stress-inducing, and very stressed. And then I had some other jobs that were really very, very stressful. I guess I was always a little bit afraid all the time. And when I got into graduate school, my fear escalated because I didn't want to go back to running a restaurant. You know, I wanted to stay in graduate school, and it was very competitive. So I guess I had a lot of stress problems, and I couldn't cope with it after a while. So I went to a Tibetan center, Tibetan Buddhist center in Seattle, but there was no resident teacher there. But I had actually read a book about how to meditate, and I I tried to meditate in the meditation hall of that little building the Tibetan people had. And then I heard about Genki Roshi, and I went to sit with Genki Roshi. And I have to tell you, it was really a deliverance, you know, because I was under so much stress. I was so afraid of failing. And I had been, you know, afraid earlier of losing my job and being a failure and so on. And now I was afraid of flunking out of school, and I was under a lot of pressure, in my opinion. And when I started to do Zazen, it really helped. It really helped. I would finish up sitting and feel, if I was at an 8 when I had stress, I would finish my sit with maybe about a 4. And so even, you know, even though it was physically challenging for me to do meditation, it helped me enormously to do it. And I got able to deal with things in a much less terrified way. Everything that happened wouldn't send me through the ceiling, you know. And I wouldn't flip out, you know. And that was very helpful. That sort of panic. I used to have like a panic type attacks sometimes if I thought things were going down the tubes. In my teaching too, I first couple times I taught, I would come home and think, my God, this is a nightmare, you know. I can't believe this is happening, you know. But go to sit, come down off my anxiety, and be very calm after a while. So it was really quite wonderful. And I think part of Zen practice is learning how to detach. You know, learning how to detach. It's very important to realize that you have a kind of freedom from everything around you. And it's much more profound than people realize. You know, most people never get outside ordinary reality. They never do. You know, all day long they're like in ordinary reality. And so when things don't go right, they become very anxious and fearful or angry, you know, or envious or self-destructive, whatever. There's like a kind of collective world we live in. And we call it reality, right? It's not real, but we call it reality. And it's not necessarily a very welcoming place, not necessarily very supportive or kindly. It's a difficult place sometimes. My good friend Richard Miller is chairman of the English department right now. And he has been chair for the last, this is his 6th year, he's been chairman for 6 years. Everybody in the department thinks Richard Miller has been an incredibly good chairman. He is so dynamic, he's done so many things for our department. He's recruited new colleagues who are very good colleagues, really excellent scholars. He's raised our reputation. Every year they rate all the English departments in the United States, and somebody somewhere looks at all the ratings and publishes them. And every year Rutgers English Department has gone up from like 19th to 18th, 18th to 17th, 17th to 16th, you know. So our reputation is, this is what English professors care about, you know, national reputation. So Richard has greatly improved our department, and he's made many innovations. We have a video production studio in the English department now. We train people to do multimedia productions and to write scripts. None of this existed. So Richard's done a brilliant job for 5.5 years, but we have a new dean who just came in, and the dean hates Richard's guts. to put it bluntly. It was like hate at first sight, you know. And it's complicated because my friend has offended some people in the higher up administration. He is a doer and a go-getter, and he's a very compassionate person, but sometimes he'll butt heads with people. And so he has, you could say, enemies. And enemies have influenced the dean, and the dean has decided he hates my friend. Okay. Now this is what we call reality, right? This is like a classic slice of reality. And I know this is eating away at my friend. He's a very sophisticated person. But the last time I saw him, he said, "Well, you know, the dean has really taken the wind out of my sails." Well, I think what that really means is that my friend feels he has mornings where he gets up and he thinks, "I don't know if I can get up, and I don't know if I can go to work." I know that he's been on antidepressants, you know. So it's been hard for him. You know, one minute he was the king of the world, basically. If you asked anybody in my department, they'd say, "Richard Miller, well, he's the best chair we've ever had." And now, the dean would say, "That guy's a troublemaker, he's no good, you know, and I can't wait to get him out of here," see. So, what happened? You know, one minute my friend could do no wrong, and the next minute he's the object of sort of like persecution. Now, you know, basically this happens to all of us all the time. I mean, when I was young, these kinds of things would happen to me too on the job. When I was running that restaurant, I had to report to Mr. Bolt, who was the manager of the hotel where the restaurant was located. And Bolt, I could never tell how he felt about me. You know, he was one of these guys, it was like if you put a piece of butter in his mouth, it might not melt, you know, because he was so cold, you know, and he was very unsupportive, you know. If there were complaints, you know, he let me know right away. I've gotten some complaints. So he never was hostile, but he wasn't supportive. He never said good job. And so I always felt like I was going to get the axe, you know. And in those days, I think I had maybe 14 dollars in the bank, you know. So getting the axe meant a lot to me. I guess I could have, you know, called my dad up and said, "Could you bail me out?" But I didn't want to do that, you know. So anyway, you know, we all have stresses like that. We all have situations where we think, I was sitting here thinking about this last night, my poor friend, you know, it must be hell for him. Because he's in a situation where the thing he wanted to do best was run the English department. He wanted to be a wonderful administrator and make many things happen, and he did, you know. But now instead of getting a pat on the back, he's getting a kick in the pants in a big way, you know. And it must feel like, you know, that sometimes this stuff happens to people, right? You wake up one morning and you think, "I can't believe this is happening to me." Yeah? It's like, "I can't believe this is happening." I'm sure my friend goes through the day right now and he rubs his eyes and he says, "I can't believe this is happening to me." There used to be a cartoon which probably none of you have ever seen, but it was I think it involved a turtle and a wizard. It doesn't sound familiar, does it? But the thing is, the turtle would get into trouble. He would be sent into back in time or to different places by the wizard, and he'd always screw it up, you know. So he might go back in the Middle Ages and get to be a knight, and he'd get to wear armor even though he was a turtle. It was a cartoon, you know. So anyway, he'd always screw it up, and just as he was about to be wiped off the face of the earth, he'd go, "Mr. Wizard, get me out of here!" And then there would be this magical circle. This magical circle would start spinning around him, and the next thing you know, he'd be safe back in his house with the wizard. And the wizard had a little spell that would end time for this one to come home, right? It was some phony rhyme, you know. Drizzle, drazzle, drozzle, drome. Time for this one to come home, right? And that turtle would be mysteriously taken to a safe place, you know. This really, in fact, if you saw The Matrix, he's being pursued by a bunch of those guys in suits. At one time he says, "Mr. Wizard, get me out of here." And that's a reference to this cartoon. So it really existed. I'm not making it up. But I think my friend must wish he could just go, "Mr. Wizard, get me out of here." And a magic circle would go around him. And the next thing you know, he'd be in his office again. And everybody would be coming in, shaking his hand and saying what a good job he's doing. I guess I had times like that too. When I was in graduate school, I remember there was a professor who failed me for a paper I wrote. Can you believe it? I worked very, very hard to get a good grades in graduate school because I didn't want to flunk out. I didn't want to go back to running a restaurant, which was very frightening at the time. I was so frightened of working in the restaurant that I really worked hard in graduate school. This guy didn't like the critical approach I used on my paper, and he failed it. He said, he didn't put a grade on it. He said, "I want to see you after class." And I thought maybe he was going to go, "You're a genius," you know. But no, he didn't say that. It was like, he said, he just went through it and said, "This is like a deliberate misrepresentation of the author's argument, blah, blah, blah." And he implied almost that it was like cheating. And he just tore me to pieces, basically. At the end, he said, I said, "Well, there's no grade on this." He said, "Well, it would be an F." And then I said, "Well, do you want me to, you know, leave your course or..." And he really was unkind, you know. I asked him if I could redo the paper, and he let me redo it, and I had to do it just his way, you know. So, you know, he had been pushing a particular way of reading English poetry, and so, you know, basically I just did it exactly his way, and I got out of the course, you know. I years ago I ran into him at a conference, actually at one point he had probably had a guilty conscience about this, or maybe he was just embarrassed to see me, I don't know. But it really terrified me, and at that moment I was sitting there thinking, you know, "Mr. Wizard, get me out of here, you know, please take me to a safe place, you know." And we all have those moments, right, where, and I think, you know, we have problems with tension and fear and so on and so on. We come to Zen, you know, and Zen is sort of like Mr. Wizard, right? You know, there is a Mr. Wizard element to this, and it's very real. It's like there really is a Mr. Wizard, you know. If you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath, if you concentrate very, very hard, but not too hard, right? If you concentrate too hard, you'll just make yourself tense. But if you concentrate on your breath, and you don't wander around in your head too much, you'll eventually find that your mind begins to have fewer thoughts. You begin to have a sort of like a blank mind. This is like the beginning of mushin, at the beginning of encountering a door into your big mind. If you go into this mushin, it really is like Mr. Wizard, you know. no matter what is bothering you, no matter what is chasing you or troubling you, it's deeply, deeply liberating. You know, every day we recite the Heart Sutra. And in the Heart Sutra, it actually says, if you look at it, it says that if you go into deep mushin, there is nothing that cannot be overcome. Nothing. Even if you're in hell, if you go into deep mushin, it will clear away all obstacles. And the bodhisattva who is offering this teaching says, this is the truth. It's not a lie. You know, he says, in this condition, there's no past and present. There's no here and there. There's no sound. There's no form. There's no ear, eye, nose, and mouth, and so on and so on. And for those of you who are practicing the mu koan, this is where you want to be. When you call mu and you squeeze your hara, as your breath goes out, 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 if you look into your mind's eye, you'll notice that it might be blank and dark or blank and light. And this is where you want to go. It's quite imperative that you go there. And if you're really deeply in mushin, you're really deeply in mu, you will find that in a certain sense, everything seems to become very remote. Everything becomes very, very remote. And your mind is focused on this blankness. It's as though you're at this very, very still, empty place. And it can be in the midst of all kinds of commotion and turmoil. Or it can be in the midst of pain. But if you call mu and you follow the breath out and you find this blankness, please just keep returning your consciousness to this blankness. And sooner or later you will notice that you can deal with pain, fatigue, all kinds of commotion very effectively. Please trust your mushin power. You know, ordinary people don't know about mushin. They don't. They're caught up in the collective fantasy. And they can take antidepressants. And if you're taking antidepressants, keep taking them. That's fine. Nothing wrong with that. Life is very challenging. And antidepressants are okay. I'm not putting them down. Having mu power is much better than antidepressants. Because, you can only take so many antidepressants. And what has to really change is the way you interact with the world. And if you can find mu, you can have a very different relationship to the world around you. I promise you that you can go more deeply into mu than you ever dreamed possible. I can sit for a long time. This morning we sat for three sits in a row. And on Saturdays we sit for five, if you want to, you can sit for five sits in a row on a Saturday if you don't take a bathroom break. And I can actually sit many more sits than that. And people often assume that when I sit I have no physical pain. But this is actually not true. I do have pain. But what I know how to do is to go deeply into mushin. And when I'm deeply in mushin, my pain pretty much disappears. And also everything else disappears as well. Everything. And I'm in absolutely still, motionless, empty, formless place. And this, if you stay in this place long enough, you begin to have like a kind of secret energy, like secret energy. If you, many people get into mushin, and we call this blank place mushin, mind of emptiness. They get into that blankness, but shallowly, shallowly. So they go into that blankness, and it, maybe they're frightened of it, or maybe it's okay. But they just sort of stay there, and nothing is happening. And this can go on for a long time, but sometimes people are troubled. You know, they're troubled, and or they're unhappy, or there's something wrong with their situation. And those people have a special advantage, because when they encounter mushin, they jump in, right? And when you jump deeply into mushin, and you just get deep, 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 deep into mushin, the most amazing things can happen. And one of the things that happens is that you begin to have this extraordinary energy. Just keep going. I promise you will notice it. You know. No matter what your problem is in life, you can deal with it by going into mushin. And mushin is like indestructible, absolutely imperturbable place. And if you haven't found it yet, please keep following, breathe, contract your hara. The breath goes out, out, out. At the end of your breath, try to look at your mind. And occasionally your mind will be blank and dark, and you want to just keep returning your consciousness to that place. Very important. And if you go there long enough, you will begin to feel much better. Much better. It's so healing and restorative and liberating. You know, people think, one way to think of it is like a door out of this world, right? It's like a door out of this world. So if you're, if you want to get out of this world, please go through that door. Yeah? Please, jump in. Eventually, what you'll notice is that you can return to this world once you've been in there a little while, once you've had a little breather. And when you do, it's a very different kind of place. If you go deeply into mushin and you come out again, you may find that your mind is now very different, very different. So if you're very agitated, fearful, something's bothering you, go deeply into mushin, deep as you can possibly go. Yeah? And sooner or later, you'll come out of mushin, and you'll notice that your mind is now quite different, like serene. So all these things that bothered you before, you'll be able to deal with like serene mind. It's a beautiful experience, right? To be, you know, and nobody likes being terrified or frightened or worn away at by events. And when you go into deep mushin, it's like going into this door into another world. But the interesting thing is, you know, if you go through that door, you wind up back in this world, you know. Why that is, I'd rather not explain, but if you go into the deepest mushin, sooner or later you're going to wind up right back here. And when that happens, you're going to notice, if you've been practicing diligently, that your mind is now rather different from when you went into mushin. There's a kind of lasting serenity or imperturbability in the midst of everything that's unfolding around you. Yeah? And this is a unified mind in accord with the way. It's a unified mind in accord with the way. When you're in this state, everything is beautiful and alive and flowing naturally. This is a place where the mind becomes unified, the whole being becomes unified with the world. So the part of you that worries is not your whole being. It's just one little part of you. And there's a deeper part of you that is your blank mind. And that's, we say, that's your, we call it your true nature, or Buddha nature. And then there's one more part of you, which is this world. And Zen practice is about like integrating all of this together. And when you've integrated them together properly, everything becomes alive and pure. Everything, without exception. And that state of mind is difficult to achieve, but it's certainly achievable. And you can do it. You can do it. So koans are one way of cultivating this kind of deep, diamond-like awareness. You know, a function of a koan is to let you go deep into wuxin, and then to encounter something in the world that troubles you, that feels very separate from yourself. Something that causes you fear, or makes you angry, or makes you feel, you know, that's, that when you have that feeling like, I can't believe this is happening, get me out of here, that is the realm of samsara. That's a samsaric mind. I can't believe this is happening. I can't believe this is happening. Get me out of here. That's samsara. And so when you go deeply into Mushin, and the teacher gives you a koan, the koan is really saying, let's look at something in the world that is the source of our samsaric consciousness, something that makes us unhappy, often. And so you work with the koan and you encounter something that maybe makes you unhappy, or that you don't understand, or that you're afraid of, or... And then if you keep working with the koan, and you keep going back into deep machine, eventually your mind is transformed and the world has become unified. It's a unified mind in accord with the way. Everything becomes alive, serene. And people go through this process over and over again, and eventually they have a great awakening experience. When you're going through this process, the world becomes bigger and bigger and more alive, instead of smaller and smaller and more dead and frightening. See? So the Zen way of living is actually to go deeply into Mushin and then to encounter things that are frightening, alienating, offensive, whatever, you know, not anything that induces samsaric mind. So basically anything that produces a sense of revulsion, or anything that makes you want to say no to the moment. Is that as soon as you say no to this moment, you're in samsara. You're in the realm of delusional mind. And so anything that makes you want to say no to this moment is is what you have to work through on the cushion by entering deep mushin. And of course, there are little challenges and big challenges, but the whole Zen way of life is about again and again encountering things that we want to say no to, and going deeply into mushin and then embracing them. So we transform what we hate or fear or reject into something that becomes life-sustaining and energizing and liberating. Because actually, nothing in the world is actually inherently samsara. It's just our perception of things. So when you feel, get me out of here, I can't believe this is happening, or you feel, I hate this, I hate this, I hate this, or when you feel the stirring of revulsion, like with recoiling or withdrawing, you know you're in samsaric mind, and the goal is to go deeply into mushin. And if you come out of it and you're still in samsaric mind, then it's back into mushin. But sooner or later, you're going to come out of samsaric mind and you're going to be in this beautiful, serene state. And that everything that happens around you will be unfolding like in the most beautiful way, like everything will seem absolutely no obstruction. Everything is just unfolding naturally. Yeah. And now everything that happens is unfolding naturally, actually, if you think about it. Because nothing that is happening can be other than what it is. This is so important to understand. You know, my friend Richard must be thinking, what did I do wrong? You know, if only I had done this instead of this. Or, you know, he must be, part of the reason we suffer so much is that we blame ourselves absurdly for what's happening. If only I'd done this, why did I do this? But you know, actually, everything that happens has to happen. This is so important. You know, it's possible that, someday we'll have a nuclear war. It's possible. When I was growing up, we thought the United States was going to have a nuclear war with the Soviet Union. And when I was a little boy, we used to have drills, nuclear attack drills. It's absurd, but it's true. And we used to have a drill where we would get up and then squat down and cover our heads it would be like you'd squat down and put your head down on your knees then put your hands over your head. And this was called duck and cover. And in fact, there was a little cartoon where it had a duck, really. And it was a little song, Duck and Cover. And it would say, remember, duck? And then they'd show the duck, and then it would say, cover. You know, and you'd drop to your... And this was in case of nuclear attack. Of course, if a nuclear attack happens, you know, this isn't going to help, right? I mean, this is just so the bodies will be easier to sweep up, right? You know, But it was a pacification. You know, they wanted to make people less panicky, so they gave them strategies for dealing with the possibility. It was like, don't worry, we've got it all figured out, right? You know, just duck and cover, you'll be okay. No, really, I swear. Check it out. Go online and write duck and cover, nuclear war, and all of this will be revealed to you. You know, so the point is we. We were given a line of BS, and we were all expecting to have a nuclear war. Now it could still happen, you know. And if I knew nuclear war was going to break out tomorrow, or even like in the next hour, you know, You could cry, you could get mad, you could say, ah, what? You know, you could eat yourself up. But that's like samsara, right? Why be in samsara? You know, what I would do, of course, being, I would just sit. I would do zazen, of course. Yeah. And I would. If I knew, it's like nuclear, the bomb's going to hit in 20 minutes. It would be like, where's that damn cushion, you know? Get on my cushion, sit down, and start watching. Move, go, move. You know, I want to be in deep mushin, and then I want to be fully present at the obliteration of the world, you know? Because that's, you know, I didn't say I approved of it, you know, and I would certainly try not to have it happen. But maybe it has to happen. And maybe whatever happens has to happen. Maybe it's a learning experience for humanity, you know. We have to learn the hard way by blowing ourselves to bits. But I'm not going to be unhappy about it, actually. I'm going to unify my mind in accord with the way. I'm going to enter deep mushin, and I'm going to be in Buddha mind when everything is atomized, you know. And I'm going to be fully present and unified with the obliteration of the world. And that could sound really crazy, right? But I think that's a great spiritual victory. You could go into this event with loathing, horror, hatred, but I'm going to go into it with Buddha mind, with serenity, compassion, loving heart, open, unconditional openness to this moment. I'm going to do it. You know, that's the way. That's the Zen way. That's a unified mind in accord with the way. Of course, you didn't make World War III start. You know, that's somebody else's karma, right? Maybe you tried to keep it from happening. But when it happens, you know, I'm not going to say no. I'm not going to push the button, you know, because it's wrong to destroy everything. But if it's being destroyed, I'm going to be there fully in Buddha mind with it. So whatever arises, I am going to unify myself with it. And when I feel aversion or revulsion or anger, fear, etc., I know I'm in samsaric mind. I'm going to go deeply into mushin, deep into mushin. And sometimes, sometimes you get off the cushion and you say, well, I didn't do it, you know. I'm too tired. I can't maintain my concentration. And that's okay. Go take a nap, get back on the cushion, and try again. And this is a challenge. This is the challenging life. But sooner or later, you're going to experience this imperturbable calm. Everything is going to be like a diamond-like in its transparency to you, and this is like a deeply awakened state, and everything is sweet and pleasant. Even things that you might have thought before were revolting and offensive. So please just keep practicing with great diligence, and this unified mind is accessible to you. When you encounter something that offends you or troubles you or makes you feel blocked or hemmed in, jump deeply into mushin. When you come out, see how you feel. If you have that serene mind, great. If you don't, back into mushin, you know? And just keep going. And actually, we Zen people look for challenges, you know? I mean, people can isolate themselves. You know, you could have a beautiful estate, you could have the guards at the gate, and so on and so on, and no problems. But it'd be impossible in that kind of a situation to develop a deep abiding mind of a bodhisattva. Bodhisattvas require challenge, yeah, require challenges. That's how you get to be a Buddha, you know, by embracing what challenges you. And as I said yesterday, you have to be like the Hamsa, that magical goose, right, that Lin Ji talked about. In Chinese mythology, there's a magical goose. And the goose is able to drink, if you mix a milk and poison, the goose is able to reach down and drink just the milk and leave the poison. It's a neat trick, right? Well, we can do that too. Every moment of our lives, we draw our nourishment from things that other people would find poisonous, right? This is the art of Zen, is to embrace what others would find poisonous and basically draw our nourishment from those things. And when we take them into us, we're not taking in poison. It's a samsaric mind that makes them look like poison. So, you know, what we're doing on the cushion is like transforming the poison into nourishing milk. Only the truth is there is no poison, it's just our thinking self. Yeah? Kasan said, learning by study is hearing. Learning no more is called nearness. Transcending the two is true passing. That's it, like unified mind in accord with the way. A monk asked, what is true passing? And Kasan said, beating the drum. It's like when you go deeply into mushin and you free yourself from samsaric consciousness, everything is like one big life. It's like a beautiful unfolding of one big life, right? You know, it's like everything that's happening is like one great action. One great action, one great unfolding. And if that's not how you experience this moment yet, back into mushin, please. But it will happen. It'll be absolutely wonderful. Secho's verse, dragging a stone, carrying earth, use the spiritual power of a 1,000-ton bow. Zokatsu Roshi rolled out 3 wooden balls. How could they surpass Kasan's beating the drum? Yeah, there's nothing that can surpass a unified mind in accord with the way. I will tell you, what is sweet is sweet, what is bitter is bitter. I'll stop, there's just one more thing. You know, there's a famous Zen saying, before I did Zen, mountains were mountains and rivers were rivers. Then when I started to do Zen and could go deeply into mushin, mountains were not mountains and rivers were not rivers. But now that I've been practicing for a long time, mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers, see? So basically, when you start practicing Zen, you're in so-called reality, right? Full of fear, loathing, hatred. I like this, I don't like that. I like him, I don't like that. This is good, this is bad, okay. Then you go into deep mushin, and this is where the purification happens. Right, and when you have been in deep mushin long enough, and you re-enter a world, just re-enter the moment of form, lo and behold, everything is transformed. It's all a beautiful diamond-like purity, one great life unfolding. So it takes a lot of sitting to get to that third stage, but we do it in little steps. So everybody's doing a magnificent job. Really magnificent. This is Zen practice. Really, what you all are doing is real Zen practice. Encountering challenges in yourself, encountering challenges in the moment, and working through them by going deeply into mushin. This is pure practice. So just keep doing the wonderful job that you're doing.